From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. The coronavirus has become the deadliest pandemic in more than a century. It has altered our lives and has upended our livelihoods. Countless jobs lost or furloughed across retail, hospitality, and the travel industry. More than 3 million Americans have applied for unemployment benefits, the most in history. This hour, On Point, coronavirus and economic hardship across America. We will begin this hour in upstate New York with Alyssa Court. She is executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project and author of several books, including Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Alyssa, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So help us understand what the Economic Hardship Reporting Project is trying to do right now in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Well, we've focused our reporting like a laser beam on coronavirus-related material. So we've assigned pieces to workers who are being laid off or who are struggling to go to work in places that are not protecting them adequately. We're also focusing on the broader things about what the economy is doing to us all now that we've had to close so many businesses and sectors.
So the goal of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project is to change the national conversation about poverty and economic insecurity. You're really trying to put a human face on financial instability, which right now for many, many people is significant.
Exactly. And we've been doing this for a long time. We started with an idea from the great Barbara Ehrenreich in 2012 because she didn't want only the wealthy to be able to write about poverty. This was after the last recession in 2008. And I think she had a vision. She didn't want there to just be David Brooks writing on the people who are having the hardest time. She wanted
as wonderful as he is. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. But she wanted it to be, you know, people, working class people,
yeah,
and middle class journalists who are freelancers, many of whom have been laid off.
And so you bring the stories of economic hardship to platforms where they might not otherwise run, written by people who might otherwise never appear in a place like that.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I can give you an example. We found a writer whose husband, he was a vet. He had lost a limb, and then he became an opioid addict and died of an overdose. And she wrote about that experience and how it was only out of his death that she was able to afford higher education and a home, and the tragedy of that. She had not written very much for broad publication. I revised her work a lot. We got in the Washington Post, and now she has a book deal to write about this experience. Mm. So she's a person that we try to reach and help. These are experienced writers, but they may come from non-traditional backgrounds.
Got it. So right now, in the midst of this pandemic, which has been life-altering for so many people, especially really America's most vulnerable population, right? Even just within the course of a week, so much has changed. Give me a sense of your reporting so far, Alyssa.
So we've done a piece with The Guardian. We co-publish because we believe that that's the best way to change mainstream media and reach the most people. We don't just want to hoard on our site. We want to get it out there as far and wide. So we co-published with The Guardian a piece about five people who had recently lost their jobs. I think one of them is going to be on the show later in the hour. I personally wrote a piece in Slate about gig workers who were not being given adequate supplies to protect themselves. And I believe one of my subjects will be on the show later. Mm-hmm. That was shocking to me. And I found out about that on social media when she was saying that she was using Everclear alcohol, which is a rot gut alcohol, to clean her phone. And she was being exposed, she felt, to the coronavirus on a minute-by-minute basis when she was shopping for other people.
Mm. You also co-published an article this week, a piece written anonymously by a low-income worker at a call center. A person told to come into work in cramped quarters, highly vulnerable to the virus. Talk about that piece and what this person was going through.
So yeah, this was somebody that I found through a friend who's an experienced writer. He fell on some hard times, and he really needs this job working at a call center for a cable company at $17 an hour. But he was very afraid and still is. He's going into work. He has to take buses and trains to get there in New York City. It's the height of the pandemic. And he was working at hot desks, which I don't know if you're familiar with hot desks, but that now seems like this artifact of a happier age where people would go from desk to desk. They won't have their own desk, which means obviously that the germs would be spreading. Whoever had the desk last, you'd have to hope that they just didn't have the virus. So that's been his experience working day in and day out at this place. And he's deemed essential labor, even though he feels he could definitely work from home. Hmm.
And very vulnerable to catching the virus, obviously, but has a boss who says you're coming in and you're coming in to do your work.
And what are you going to do? Or then you lose the apartment you have with roommates, many of whom are younger than you, who are themselves maybe carrying the virus. You know, there's a whole domino effect that's going to happen on a lot of people's lives. And he was just one of the more striking stories I've come across so far.
So nearly 3.3 million Americans filed for unemployment last week. And it seems quite possible, Alyssa Cord, as you know, that those numbers, those jobless numbers, could go even higher. With so many people fresh out of work, you know, it's devastating. But coronavirus has, as you write, exacerbated existing poverty and financial insecurity for many, many people. Talk about that, would you?
Absolutely. So I think we've had a structural failure, and this is part of how Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have gotten so far in the primary campaigns to begin with. People realize there's something very wrong in this country, that they can't afford health care, that they are drowning in debt and from their student days and from their any kind of medical bills they might have, that they can't afford to own homes when they're millennials. So this has been happening. And the numbers, the job numbers, this cheery job numbers, I feel like a Cassandra, an angry Cassandra at this point, because I was constantly saying, hey, these are for retail work, or these are contingent work. These are not great secure jobs. If anything was to happen, we're one crisis away from people losing their jobs. At that point, I thought a minor scale, but now a mass scale. So this is just shining a light on that, on the fragility of this economy and the lack of social support we have.
On Point, listeners, let us ask you, how has the coronavirus pandemic impacted you? Have you lost your job? Are you wondering how you're going to pay the rent, put food on the table? Let me bring in now from Menlo Park, California, via Skype, Vanessa Bain. Until recently, she worked for the grocery delivery app Instacart. Alyssa, welcome to On Point, Vanessa. Nice to have you.
Nice chatting with you, Jane.
So you have patched together work at Instacart and DoorDash and Uber Eats. Tell us your story. Are you working right now?
I stopped working on March 13th. I unfortunately didn't feel safe in continuing to work. I have elderly grandparents that I take care of. I also have a child that I'm responsible for. And as much as it's very, very, very hard to turn away income as a precarious worker, there are things that matter more to me, like the health and safety of myself, my family, my community, my customers. And I had to make a really, really hard decision to walk away from working.
And so what are your coworkers who are still on the job, still working in those frontline sort of positions? How are they dealing with it?
Not well. You know, pardon me. Every time we enter a grocery store, we're exposing ourselves to an inherent set of risks that's significantly higher than most other places that we could be. The stock at stores is just depleted into almost non-existent ability to fulfill orders as they're ordered. And as I'm sure I don't have to tell listeners, you know, there's not toilet paper in stores. There's not a lot of canned goods in stores. There's no sanitizers, no disinfectants. And these are the things that people are most commonly ordering. The entire system has really been thrown out of whack. And the folks that are continuing to do this work are doing it under profound stress and anxiety, as well as, you know, risk to their physical well-being. We actually called this morning for an emergency walk-off of all Instacart shoppers until Instacart fixes the situation and provides us with necessary prophylactics to do our work safely.
I saw that cross the wire just a few minutes ago, that Instacart shoppers will walk off their jobs. They'll not return to work until their demands are met, including safety yes. precautions at no cost to workers, hand sanitizer, disinfectant wipes, sprays and soaps, hazard pay, an extra $5 per order, and a defaulting in-app tip that amounts to 10% of the order total. I mean, these seem like basic things, but in a time like this, it's workers like you and your colleagues who are very vulnerable and sort of get short shaft.
Absolutely. And Alyssa wrote a really phenomenal piece about how we're functioning in the capacity of first responders during this pandemic. You know, we're keeping families fed. It's not people at Instacart's corporate headquarters that are out there personally risking their health and safety. It's shoppers, you know, and we're people who are misclassified employees. So we're entitled to none of the protections of traditional employment. And Instacart has really failed to protect us in this situation. And so we've had to take matters into our own hands.
Alyssa Quart, these are minimum wage workers. These are American workers. This is our workforce, right? And how are we treating them?
Well, not very well. And I did make this argument that they were first responders. They may not look like the EMT at the 9/11 site or the fireman at the burning building, but that is the service that people, Uber drivers, one just died after driving someone with coronavirus. That's what Instagram workers, Instacart workers, DoorDash, Uber Eats, a lot of them are doing this work for us.
Well, we're discussing the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on the American worker this hour. Much more to come, including your calls. Stick with us. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about coronavirus and how it's impacting the most vulnerable Americans. We're joined this hour by Alyssa Quart, Executive Director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, and also Vanessa Bain, a gig economy worker, one of many impacted so hard by coronavirus. Vanessa was telling us before the break, you're taking care of both your grandparents, your great-grandmother, you have a young child. How are you supporting yourself? What sort of safety net do you have in this time now when you're not working? You're out of work.
Yeah, the short answer is I don't really have any. I have one, which is that I don't pay market rate rent. I have a studio that's on my grandmother's property. And so, you know, the largest expense that most people really wrestle with is rent. And it's also the most important because keeping yourself sheltered right now is really important. But, you know, the short answer is I don't have any savings. I barely earn enough to pay my bills every month. And, you know, I applied for food stamps. I already qualify for Medi-Cal and I've applied for unemployment as well. But, you know, I'm sure I don't have to tell you guys the you know, application process, you know, once you've filed, it's extended out so far. Over a million Californians have already applied for unemployment. So I'm playing a waiting game right now of waiting to hear back. I have a telephone appointment with our county for SNAP benefits, but that's scheduled out till April 17th. So right now we're really just trying to you know, stretch the food that we have and make sure that we're keeping ourselves safe.
And will the president's $2 trillion relief package help you. It's $1,200 for you, an additional $500 for your daughter. How are you feeling about sort of the government response to this?
Yeah, I mean, I would say overall it's woefully inadequate. I mean, a one-time $1,200 payment is not going to keep people out of work for several months, potentially afloat. I guess it's better than absolutely nothing. But, you know, one of the problems is that we're misclassified workers, and we should have access to things like state social safety nets, paid family leave, sick time, et cetera. And I think that this crisis is doing a phenomenal job of highlighting the urgency with which we need these things. And you know, workers have been screaming into a void about this for you know, years and decades. And I'm hoping that if anything positive is to come from this crisis, it's immediate and swift action to remedy the issues that we've been dealing with.
Vanessa, I'm curious, what are you telling your young child about this, about your job, the fact that you're not working, about the pandemic, about your family's future?
Yeah, she's having a very hard time coping with everything. She's also not in school right now, which is an added complication. You know, I usually do my organizing work while she's in school. And she's having a really hard time just coping in general with the uncertainty of things. We just got a call from her school yesterday saying that, you know, school will definitely not be open before May 1st. And again, that's a deadline we're still uncertain about. So I'm trying to, you know, focus on keeping her as happy as I possibly can, but she's scared. We're all scared, you know. She has a great, great grandmother, and she's almost 95 years old. And we joke about her immortality, but she's at very high risk of dying if she contracts this disease. She has COPD, and she's almost 95 years old. Mm. So everybody is just really on edge. There's been a lot of anxiety and a lot of uncertainty.
Well, Vanessa, we wish you the very best, and we hope something comes up to you for you employment-wise, and that you can take care of your family. We really appreciate your time today expressing how this has been for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alyssa Court, what do you hear in Vanessa's story?
I'm hearing something that we're seeing throughout this country now that there's, I think, 3.3 million people claimed unemployment or attempted to. We're seeing people who just desperately need relief and they need security. And what I'm hoping is that this $2 trillion economic rescue package will provide that, at least in the short run, which is what I'm hearing, that it would probably be, it's too short to help people long term, but it might provide more immediate relief.
I've got callers lined up around the block. Let me get one in here. Liz from Livonia, Michigan. Hi, Liz. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm calling because I don't know if this is common knowledge, but cancer survivors or people in cancer treatment pay a very strong financial toll. Many of us lose our jobs, and that's what happened to me. I was working as a substitute teacher, and I got cancer, and they don't offer sick or vacation time or any of those benefits. Mm. And I did as much as I could to work when I could, mm-hmm. but my immune system was down. I was losing weight. I was struggling. And then they fired us all.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to another company, and again, they didn't pay benefits, and they fired us all. So I thought, I'm going to just look for another job. But I'm older, so I was competing with younger people, and the jobs didn't pay benefits. And then the pandemic hit.
Mm. So you're really vulnerable, Liz, from a health perspective, but also an economic, financial perspective, too, on both fronts. Liz, I wish you the best, especially with your cancer treatment. Let's go to Carrie in Augusta, Maine. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi. Go ahead.
So I'm a hospice nurse, and I'm working, going to homes and seeing people, families, patients. They're scared, as everybody is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to try to be as positive as possible and do something quirky and funny. So today I'm out seeing patients in a purple sparkly prom dress with a purple wizard's hat and am just trying to make people smile. And so far it's worked.
Well, you made us smile, perhaps for the first time today. Carrie, thank you very much and all the best to you. There is a hospice nurse right there on the front lines seeing patients. Thank you so much, Carrie.
You're welcome.
One more. Marvin is in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Marvin. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I'll be quick. I work in like a private service industry, like a luxury service industry, and our owner's got us traveling to like 20, 30 clients' houses a day. We've had some clients drop because we're obviously not like critical infrastructure, but our owner's making us go out. And if we don't, we lose our job and he replaces us. So that's the situation I've been through this. I haven't lost any work.
You haven't lost any work and you're still out there. You're still visiting 20, 30 people a day.
I'm literally doing it right now.
Wow. All right, Marvin, stay safe and be careful. Alyssa Court, three very different calls, but very interesting to hear what people are dealing with.
I agree. And I mean, I think it's a COVID-19 catch-22, whereas either you're at this point, you have a financial pinch or you have a epidemiological pinch. And it's sort of either you're going to be putting yourself, exposing yourself because your employer is asking you to, or you have to support your family by going to work, or you're going to be, you know, on the other side, risking economic suffering. So it's really a bind. Mm.
Listeners, you can join our conversation here. How has your life changed just over this last week? How are you managing? How are you managing the finances? How are you putting food on the table for the family? How are you preparing for what appears to be a tough economic road ahead? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. Leave comments there at On Point Radio. Let me go now to Chicago. Rashonda Williams is with us. She just lost her job as a bartender. Rashonda, welcome to On Point. I really appreciate you being with us.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us what you're going through right now, Rashonda.
Well, currently, like many others across the country, I've been working for a Hilton hotel. And after 19 years, my job is at jeopardy. Currently, I'm on layoff status, but there is no indication of when I'll be able to return to work. As many others here in Chicago, and because everything happens so fast, it's where do I go? What do I do?
And so what are you doing? How are you putting food on the table? How are you? What is your safety net in this moment?
Right now, I'm reaching out to friends. I have friends and family that are still working, so they are gathering around me, making sure that I'm able to eat and that I'm able to pay bills. It's been 2 weeks thus far, so I'm feeling like things are going to get a little worse a minute by minute and day by day.
And I hear that, Rashonda, you kind of meet up with some of your former coworkers to kind of commiserate and to kind of trade notes and to try to empathize with each other. Is that right?
Absolutely. I'm a shop steward, and people are very worried right now. And if I can be compassionate and empathetic, even going through the same things that they are, is now the time to be it. I just want to be the best human being that I can be for my coworkers and other people in the industry in terms of trying to relax fears as best as possible.
Well, you sound very upbeat. This is really hard on many levels for a lot of people, especially mental health-wise, right? A lot of people are struggling.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and how are you?
I'm taking day by day. I'm meditating as often as I can to keep my senses intact, and just trying to make sure that I'm reaching out to people who may not have the inner strength that I have. But, you know, it's wearing on me as well.
Well, we wish you the best, Rashonda. Thank you very much. Rashonda Williams lost her job as a bartender. Been working for 19 years there in Chicago. Good luck, Rashonda. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alyssa Court, hard-hit sectors, hospitality, travel, tourism, retail. You hear it there in Rashonda Williams' story, Alyssa.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just spoke to a bartender who we featured in a Guardian piece who had lost her job. And, you know, she said she had been prepared for this through the flexibility that her job required. And she was also a dancer and had a lot of things before in her life that had required flexibility. But this was kind of a new level. There are, and I've provided some resources. I hope to get them out. There's some bartenders groups that are forming. Some of the wealthier people in the food and beverage sector are now donating money to people like your last guest. So I'm hoping that will get to them. But we need a lot more. You know, we don't even have a moratorium on water and electricity shutoffs in the new stimulus bill. There are things that are missing, or relief of student debt. So I think that's the kind of stuff that we're going to need also for people like the bartenders and the restaurant workers.
Let me go to another call in Baltimore, Maryland. Tisha is on the line. Hi, Tisha. Welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I was calling because I am a transplant patient. I have a kidney and a pancreas transplant, and I'm also legally blind. I'm a fitness professional who teaches different fitness classes, and I do personal training, and I'm also a licensed social worker. And, you know, because I'm legally blind, and I rely on public transportation. So even before Baltimore kind of shut down to the extent that it has, I had to make the decision to kind of pull back on my travel and going to work because, you know, I'm immunocompromised, and it's really kind of affecting people who, you know, others typically would not see as a vulnerable population.
Right.
But yeah, we definitely are.
I appreciate it. It's a really important point, Tisha. Thank you there in Baltimore. Alyssa Court, low-income wage earners who rely on public transportation to get to and from jobs. So much public transportation is shut down now. And even those for like Tisha, who has, you know, she's a transplant patient. She's legally blind. She has a lot of health issues. It's just a double whammy, isn't it?
It's absolutely. And, you know, but before this happened, there's something like 40 million people living in poverty, with many of them homeless. And that's a whole other issue, right? But I had interviewed people before this happened that had to rely on GoFundMe and other crowdsourcing sites to raise money to get them to their dialysis appointments. So what I'm expecting to see is just a kind of ocean of those kind of stories. And we really need more than GoFundMe for people like your last, the last caller.
And the reality is, the reality of poverty in this country is that half of Americans don't have the resources to pay 2 weeks' worth of basic living expenses. 140 million Americans cannot afford a $400 emergency, right?
Yeah, and that's often, you know, what people think it's, oh, this is just a question of the poor. It's the near poor. It's the middle class people who are living from check to check as well. And there are many of the people I wrote about in my last book. And I'm concerned about what is going to happen with that population. I mean, one of the things that I feel like this has done is we have a harsh social class divide in this country, and it's been put on stark display in the last few weeks thanks to this virus. You know, who is getting on the private planes and buying the organic soup and lavender, or going to underground bunkers if they're really rich, and who can't afford to take a day off and is not going to be able to pay for their water and their electricity when it's shut off.
Mm. One more call in here before the break. Isabel from Sarasota, Florida. Hi, Isabel. I don't have much time, but I wanted to get you in. Go ahead.
Hi. So thank you. My husband works in the hospital, and something that I was very surprised at is a patient came in thinking he had corona and coughed on my husband. And the hospital, you would think, would put him in quarantine and test him, and there was no testing. They made him go back to work, him and two other people that were exposed. And, you know, I had him at quarantine at the house, but the hospital was making him come in and gave him, you know, just a little rinky-dink mask that he had to ask for. So it's just amazing to me, you know, how we're not taking care of the people that are being forced to go to work, not forced, but just that have to go to work, and, you know, the people that are risking their lives to try and take care of patients.
There they are on the front lines. Isabel,
yeah.
Thank you. Is Alyssa Court, another frontline nurse, right, exposed to it all and, you know, not making a lot, probably.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we really need to think long term about what we can be shifting because of this. I mean, I think every apocalypse is dystopian in its own way, but it's also potentially utopian.
Well, we're telling the stories of American workers who are suffering during the coronavirus pandemic, especially our most vulnerable American workers, and we'll continue with it after this break. Our coronavirus coverage continues on Monday. As we enter another week of physical social distancing, we're going to discuss the collective feeling of loss hanging over all of us and how we're coping with it. So we'd like to know from you, what ways have you found to manage grief during this pandemic? And what are you grieving? Loved ones, routines, a sense of normalcy? Leave us a voicemail, 617-353-0683. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're discussing a difficult period for millions of Americans' most vulnerable workers, America's most vulnerable workers. They're trying to figure out how to make it through, how to pay the rent, how to take care of their families. Alyssa Cord is with me. She's the executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. And I'd like to bring in now from New York City, Eleanor Shanahan. She was a production secretary for a cable series that's been postponed due to the coronavirus pandemic. Ellie Shanahan, welcome. It's nice to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, Jane.
So you're a production secretary, laid off. What have the last couple of weeks been like for you?
Well, I'm actually one of the lucky ones. So I am being paid for 2 weeks. And then after that, so this is the end of my second week that I will be paid for. And then after that, I just don't know. We're supposed to go back in six to eight weeks, but I don't know how certain that is. And so that's when it becomes a little trickier.
Right. And you have no idea what the future holds. You could go back in 6 to 8 weeks, or you could not go back at all. Is that right?
Right. I mean, that the idea is for them to be up and running, but if the entire country is shut down, then there's no way that that should happen.
Do you have a plan B during this time?
Well, when I graduated from college and before that, I spent a lot of time in the restaurant industry, which is obviously not something I can go back to right now.
Right.
And then I also was babysitting, and that's not something I necessarily feel comfortable doing, not only for myself and my family, but I don't know what I, you know, if I am unlucky and contract something, I wouldn't want to bring that into somebody's house.
Have you registered, Ellie, for unemployment? How are you making ends meet?
So this is the end of the second week that I will be paid for, which I feel incredibly lucky that they're even able to do that, because I know a lot of shows are not able to do that. But next week I will attempt to register for unemployment. And I've done it before, because since I'm a freelance worker, there are periods of time that I am unemployed. But I know that right now the system is kind of going berserk because everyone's trying to register.
Right. So does this time feel different in some way?
Yeah. I mean, I usually am able to apply for jobs at least, but there's no work in the industry that I work in currently. So it's not even like I can attempt to get jobs that I'm qualified for. So there isn't really necessarily an end in sight. And that's, you know, for 6 weeks, I might be fine because I prepare for times of instability like this. But longer than that, I'm not so sure.
Where will you go if you can't make it on your own?
My parents live in Washington Heights, also in New York City. So as long as I quarantine in my apartment, I live in Brooklyn for a couple weeks. I could, you know, if my lease runs out in September and I'm not able to make it anymore, I at least have that to fall back on, which I feel very lucky to have.
You're young. How are your friends dealing with this? Are they going through similar situations?
Yeah, I mean, I live with two roommates. They both fled. One went to go to her parents in Florida where she felt safer, and the other's staying with her boyfriend right now and just quarantining together. And so I'm actually alone in my apartment, which is kind of crazy, but which allows me also to not have a lot of contact with the outside world.
Well, take care of yourself, and know a lot of people are with you. Our hearts are with you. Ellie Shanahan, good luck to you, and you take care.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Ellie Shanahan from New York City, production secretary, laid off because of coronavirus. Alyssa Court, in many states, applying for benefits is a full-time job. We heard, of course, 3.3 million Americans have filed for unemployment benefits just in 1 week. I mean, with so many filings, I'm reading about websites that are overwhelmed, people spending hours just trying to get online access to fill out the claims. What does your reporting show in this area?
Well, I mean, I feel like what we should be doing is we should be paying people's salaries rather than giving, you know, one-time checks for something. I mean, in other countries, that's what they're doing. In Denmark and England, people retain their identity and their jobs and their sense of self-worth. And so part of the problem is that. The other problem is something that we see a lot of in our line of work of reporting on the economy. By the way, our website is economichardship.org if you want to read more about it. Is how much time it takes to be poor, how much work it takes, how many forms you have to fill out, is whether, you know, in good times when you're trying to get SNAP or when you're trying to get care for your kid, et cetera. It's a very laborious project to be poor. It's another job. And so that's, we're going to have millions of people who are seeing this maybe for the first time.
Back to the phones to Tampa, Florida. Hi, Joseph. You're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Good morning.
Hello.
I have a small business. Yes, can you hear me? I'm a small business owner that sells meteorological equipment to schools, and my sales have completely dried up for the busiest time of the year for us.
And so what are you doing? Are you still open? Are you closed, shuttered? Are you social distancing? I mean, are you worried about keeping this thing alive? What are you doing?
Yeah, we are definitely social distancing. We are trying to pivot into other markets that might not be as impacted by coronavirus. But I did want to bring up one point. You know, I have a grandmother who's also 97 years old, has bad Alzheimer's, and I love her very much. But at the same time, I know if something happened to her, she'd be in a better place. And so sometimes I do ask and have to wonder, how much are we jeopardizing our economy by all of this social distancing? Are we at the right balance? Should we social distance more and more impact our economy?
Joseph, thank you. Alyssa Court, President Trump, of course, has talked about this a little bit. How do you see this in the context of American workers and our vulnerable economic population?
Well, I guess I'm not able to wrap my mind around that. It seems kind of a level of, no offense to the last caller, cruelty and barbarism. That I understand what he's saying, and I know that there's certain ethics that would guide a doctor to make that decision. But my hope is that we can respect our elders enough to try to protect them rather than worry about the bottom line. It's hard to think, oh, I want to save the economy at the, you know, and sort of kill people in the process.
South Central Wisconsin, Janet is on the line. Hi, Janet, you're on the air.
Hello. I have two or three concerns. I work in a convenience grocery store that sells fuel and food, mm-hmm. and about a third or a fourth of our customers are elderly and disabled, and they come in wheelchairs and walkers to get their food. They don't have transportation or very much money. I take my own antiseptic wipes, and yet I've had my spray cleaner and gloves taken away from me because it didn't look good for customers or other staff members. And I feel that all grocery stores, including Walmart and Target, all of us that serve and work with tills, we need to clean off our till tops, we need to clean off our pin pads, and we need to be provided with these things to keep the other elderly and disabled people. And another thing I noticed is a man came in a few weeks ago, and he had snuck out of a nursing home that was shut down to buy lotto tickets. And it got me to thinking that lotto tickets and scratch tickets are not necessary. And I know a lot of people spend hundreds of dollars, if not less than that, but more, on these tickets, and they are causing it a dangerous place for all of us to both work and get our food for everybody that needs food.
Janet, thank you so much. Alyssa Court, Janet brings up an important point. That first point, you know, some stores have provided supplies for their workers, gloves, hand sanitizer, but many have not.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that should be a requirement. I had asked at some point for there to be, let's say it is for kind of an Instacart DoorDash type of service, you know, where they supply food, that maybe they should be surge pricing even higher than we're used to paying to cover the cost of that. I also think, you know, one of the things in the new stimulus bill is there aren't earmarked funds for personal protective equipment for healthcare workers. There's a lot of aid for healthcare institutions like hospitals, Medicare, Medicaid, but not for PPE, as they call it, directly. So part of it is we need to see that in healthcare, but we also, every one of these big companies that have billion-dollar evaluations, multi-billion-dollar evaluations, should be supplying this to their workers. It's just a no-brainer.
Let's go to Reggie in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Hi, Reggie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So I am a trucker for a local Wisconsin trucking company. We run the local states surrounding Wisconsin, and we do a nationwide expedited service. And we have contracts with a lot of medical suppliers and medical fabricators, metal fab shops. I'm at one right now. We are trying to keep America running. We're trying to get everyone through this. I want to remind everyone that we're working hard to help everyone out. And just to keep your hopes up, we'll all get through this, keep your distance and from each other, but also give us a little extra space. I know everyone's frustrated and focused on them and what they need to do, but when we're on the road, we're working, and we need a little extra space, and, you know, we could really benefit from that peace of mind while we're trying to be out here dealing with everything.
A little extra space and the benefit of the doubt. Reggie, a hardworking truck driver there from Wisconsin. I really appreciate your call, Reggie. Thank you. Let's get Deborah in here from Jacksonville, Illinois. Hi, Deborah. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I am a retired school teacher, and in order to make ends meet, I have continued to substitute teach as well as teach silver sneaker yoga and some water classes. And so I am wondering, as a retired person, will I be eligible for any of the extra benefits that are being offered by our government? Also, I'm concerned about the elderly because, you know, working with silver sneaker classes, people aren't able to get out, and you know, that's part of, you know, part of keeping us going as older people.
Sure.
So, you know, we need something that, you know, and so I encourage people, call, go to the park. Maybe you can do long distance yoga or something, you know,
but try
contact
something.
Your elderly. Yeah. The other thing,
Deborah,
is,
I got to go because of the time, but I'm going to get Alyssa Court in here on your one question, which is an important one. Deborah is retired. Alyssa, does she benefit? Would she benefit from those checks coming out of the stimulus bill?
I have to study it more carefully to look at for the retirees within it, because it just dropped yesterday or the, you know, a day and a half ago. But I do think that there will be some benefits for someone like her. And her point about people getting out, it's one of the things we need to remember is our mental health. And I've been hearing a lot about teletherapy, you know, therapists doing online therapy for people. Mm-hmm. And I've sent you guys some NAMI, National Institute of Mental Health resources for that. But I think that is something that we should be circulating, especially around older people that are shut in. Let's not forget about their emotional health.
So what are some of the shared lessons, Alyssa, that you've learned over the course of your work, especially during the coronavirus pandemic, that apply to us now? What do you say to people out there who are suffering, who are struggling? What should they know based on your reporting?
Well, I think that they should know that there are kind of personal do-it-yourself resources for people out there. There's this thing called mutual aid societies that are growing in this country. It's all at a site called it's all going down or something. They call them pods, and they're sort of local neighborhood groups that check in on people, the elderly, to your caller's last point. So mm-hmm. we should be looking for some of those resources, hooking up with them. But I think we also really have to take this as an opportunity to push for some of the things that have eluded us up until now, for something equivalent to Medicare for All, for making these temporary fixes, these Band-Aids, into a more permanent set of changes, because that's the only way that this is going to make any sense to me or any meaning, this level of suffering. For journalism, which is my area, I think we should start thinking about something equivalent to a federal workers project, which was part of the New Deal. And in the 1930s, journalists and photographers were put to work reporting on everything from, at that point, it was elderly slaves telling their stories, to local issues, to the Dust Bowl. I think that would be a way to create jobs that would also prop up journalism, because right now, many newspapers and magazines are closing more than had already closed.
Well, it's a good point. And beyond that, you know, we know that the federal government is stepping in with this stimulus. I'm curious how you think local communities can be more engaged during this time to take care of those who are particularly vulnerable.
Well, as I was saying, with these mutual aid groups, people have set up Google Docs where they're exchanging information. You know, where do you get, how do you do your unemployment check? How do you sign up for shopping? I mean, my mother is elderly. She needs someone to shop for her. She's out in the country. She's had to find someone that she's paying to do this. But I think there, in some of these resources are available on these Google Docs and online. We need to start circulating them more broadly in communities because, yeah, a lot of older people are going to be unable to get enough to eat.
Right. And I think a lot of people, you know, we saw the rush on toilet paper and all these things and it's not funny, but it you know, there was a little bit of levity in that. But we need to think about thoughtful and preparative steps, you know, that we need to take, because this is going to go on for a while, right? At least for another few weeks. And it's predicted that by the summer, you know, many more millions of people will lose their jobs.
Yeah, and the emotional part, I mean, I can just speak to my own experience with my young daughter who's 9. I've had to, you know, create Zoom groups for her and her friends, you know, come up with all sorts of games that no one has played since the 1970s. what do you do when your children are indoors and very anxious, you know? So this is, there's a lot to try to work on as individual families as well.
Let's get your website out there one more time, economichardship.org, correct?
Right, exactly. Economichardship.org. We're calling for stories. We're calling for journalists. We have a special project with the Eviction Lab, which is Matthew Desmond's outfit out of Princeton. So if you're experiencing housing instability in this period, we are at evictionstories@gmail.com.
Alyssa Quart, Executive Director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. You're doing such great work, and we appreciate you sharing it with us today. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Jane.
And listeners, thanks to you, callers. We appreciate it. We hope you take care out there. We're thinking of you. Our hearts are with you. Have as good a weekend as you can. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.